cinephiles, audiophiles, ladies and germs, welcome to the Film Cult Podcast. Tonight, it's the cinematographer behind Dog Eat Dog, First Reformed, After Love, The Card Counter, and the upcoming Master Gardener, not to mention this year's Goodnight Mommy, it's Alexander Dainan. Alexander, how are things?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I am doing good. Let's start this off a little bit techie. So with cameras like the Alexa 35 coming full swing into the market, how important have advances been in technology for your cinematography?
I mean, incredibly important. I came up shooting documentaries, and when I graduated college, I put all my money together and I got a Panasonic DVX-100 and a Rode microphone, and I started making stuff, and that would not have been possible, 5 or even 10 years before that. You would need a RE416 and film, and Final Cut Pro as well was like hugely helpful. All of these sort of advances in technology helped me get into making stuff quicker and seeing what just getting more time to learn. Even if I was just making some silly little documentary, at least it was, oh, interesting. Like I found out that, oh, if I put a character in shade, I could shoot them for longer because it would cut with, other stuff that I shot better, as opposed to being in direct sunlight. And, from that little Panasonic, or not so little, but from that Panasonic, then we started putting the Leetus adapter on there and putting, old Nikkors on the front to try to get some depth of field. And then 5Ds, 7Ds came along, and all of a sudden you had what is, a very professional looking image coming out of a very small camera. And then Alexas and Reds and all that helped me to find that I wanted to be a DP, find that I found this industry interesting, that I found storytelling and commercials interesting. And I think that I would have had a harder time sort of physically being able to afford to get to those things, had it not been for digital cinematography. And also, I still shoot film. I love shooting film. But it's also a different medium. Film is subtractive, digital is additive. And I really like, the fact that digital is additive, and, that I can take different layers of light and image and combine them to create shape. I see them as very different things, and I try to embrace them as very different things. So, technology has been hugely helpful in the spurring of kind of my creative imagination within digital cinematography. And then, I'm also excited about the Alexa 35. I mean, there's a lot to be excited about with that camera.
I'm okay. Be it that you brought yourself up in the documentary realm, do you feel like now when you go to a new project that you kind of approach it the same way that you did back in the day, or is that kind of gone from your mindset?
No, I think, I'm always interested in documentaries. I'm always interested in the idea of documentaries, which is you have a person telling you about something in a space, and it doesn't have to be beautiful, but sometimes you kind of want it to be, And I guess with documentaries, the idea is, okay, what do we have here and how can we use it to the best of our ability? And so that always comes into play for me. Obviously, if I'm shooting a 4-page scene, then it has to be artificial because, I need to feel the consistency between both characters. Say there's two characters in the scene, or whatever it may be, I need to feel consistency. But I'm always starting from a documentary place. I'm always going to location, and I'm looking at the way the light falls, and I'm thinking about the way that it's going to progress over the day. And if it's a short scene and we can match our interior lights to the exterior lights and kind of go with that, then that's a way that I want to work. It also helps, I think, things go faster when you know what environment you're walking into, as opposed to just putting something on top of it that's artificial or that needs to feel a certain way or that's in your head, you know? So I think I'm always open to the real life documentary, quote unquote, possibilities of a space, of a scene, of a way something should be captured. So I haven't let it go. I think it's just about, how do I now manufacture what I like about that for a longer scene if that's necessary?
Do you feel like that kind of a mindset maybe helped you a little bit when you were doing the VR sequences for the card counter? Because it's like you were going crazy with like what you were doing with that image. Like, I guess explain the entire process behind the VR, because was that from you? Was that from Paul? Where did that all come from? Like, how did I just come to be?
Yeah, for sure. Well, Paul wrote in the script, in the original script in the card counter, that he wanted the those flashback sequences to feel like a VR experience. And that was like kind of a head scratcher for me, because I was like, wow, I mean, we're making, you know, what is a 2D projected film. You know, how do you make that feel like some sort of 3D experience? And so, you know, I started kind of just mulling that over. And I love when a director gives me a challenge like that, because it just like, it gets to the tech side of me. It gets to the, you know, emotional side of me. It gets to the person who loves shooting side of me. You know, it all sort of like invigorates all those things. And I love when you can start to use technology in an interesting and new way that feels unique, even if the elements that you're using are not unique. You're not inventing something that no one has ever done before, which is super cool and amazing. And I hope to be able to do those type of things someday, but within the constraints of a small movie like Card Counter, we had to kind of use what was available already to us. So I started kind of like bumming around the internet, and I found these videos that people had taken with GoPros in 3D rigs or other sort of 3D cameras, and which they had uploaded it to YouTube, but the YouTube player at the time really couldn't handle like 3D images or images captured in that way. And so everything was like really warpy. Everything was presented 2D, but everything that kind of came around the edges started to get really warpy. I remember it was like this video of a guy like paragliding. And I saw it, and then I started doing more research about it, and I showed Paul, and I was like, Paul, is there something here? Is this interesting? Because, you know, to me, not only did it kind of play into that idea of being in a VR world, but it also kind of coupled with the idea of William Tell in a dream flashback in a place that we've seen images of before. We've seen all these horrific images of Abu Ghraib. They've been recreated again and again in films, and they're truly horrific, but, you know, in a way just presented as they are. So how do we get to the emotional heart of what the character is experiencing a little more? And there was something in the bending and strangeness of that world, of those, you know, strange GoPro images that kind of spoke to me in some way. So then that just launched me on this whole like research, you know, where basically for 2 months, this is way before we started prep on the film, but just was trying to figure out, okay, what are the different ways of doing this? Because also Paul talked about wanting to be in his POV. And I was like, okay, if we want to be in his POV, then we're kind of thinking about Steadicam. We're thinking about, or something that kind of could allow us to track through the space. And so how do we go about doing this on a Steadicam or doing this on a robot or whatever it may be? And so I was eventually led to using this very wide angle lens that was developed for VR, and then partnered with a post-production company that essentially took the images that I made in this, which were our fisheye lens images, so complete, you know, black circle, images, and then expanded them out to give me that really strange warping effect. And through a whole different series of research, I worked with a really great technician. We were able to kind of come up with something that I felt was interesting, and that spoke to it. And eventually, we figured out how to put it on a Steadicam. You know, the we ended up shooting it on Red, because even though the majority of the film is shot on Alexa LF, because we needed a smaller body to kind of cantilever the lens off of the front of the Steadicam body. And I worked with Nick Mueller, the phenomenal Steadicam artist, to figure out how to almost invert the way that the Steadicam works, because usually you put all the way at the top and then the batteries are at the bottom, and that counterweight is what allows for a seamless float. But all of a sudden we need to take this camera and we need to put it way in the front of the rig. And it also has to be almost very light to do so. But then, you know, he then took batteries and made a long plate at the bottom so that it would sort of invert the idea of it. And then he operated off of like a little, you know, almost like 5-inch monitor that was hanging by his side. And he operated with it way out in front of him so that we didn't see him. So it was sort of all those different things, the technology, the emotional side of it, all being blended together from that one idea in the script. I want this to feel like a VR experience.
Do you find yourself, I guess, trying to go away from the typical like dolly and sticks approach when you think about a scene, or is that really your base? Should it be this? And then we'll think about it afterwards. Like maybe it will go on to Steadicam, but like, where do you kind of start when you're thinking about how a scene is kind of going to look?
I mean, I started talking to the director. You know, I start talking to the director about what they feel, what the language of the film is. You know, I love, you know, classical, you know, cinematography. I love the cinematography of the 50s, 60s, and 70s. I mean, obviously 70s gets more radical, but, you know, I love the sort of, you know, original tenets of dolly and sticks, you know, not moving the camera, only moving the camera when it's, a character is moving, you know, all those things are certainly like my preference. But at the same time, you know, you have to respect what's going on in the characters, what's going on emotionally in the scene, and everything comes from that. You know, Steadicam, you know, in Card Counter, Steadicam wasn't originally in our idea. You know, we'd made First Reform. Paul and I had made First Reform together. That was you know, film which really didn't move the camera at all, and that was a certain aesthetic choice. But Paul liked that idea, and we were thinking about, okay, how do we, you know, bring some of those ideas from First Reformed into Card Counter? And we had been doing a lot of scouting in different casinos all over the U.S. And every casino that we went into, it just, there was a monotony to it, because most casinos are not, it's no, gone are the days of, you know, 1970s where there are independent people who own these casinos, you know, on Reno and, you know, Vegas and all that. Now most of them are owned by corporate entities, and it's like a very defined aesthetic, you know, of we want people to gamble, the rugs are going to be crazy, the walls are going to be beige, and that's kind of going to be it. You know, we don't want anything to distract from the psychology of going to the machines or whatever, you know, research they've done. And we both kind of got into this idea of like, wow, we were in Mississippi, but we could be in New York, we could be in Florida, we could be anywhere that there's gambling. And the monotony of walking those casinos kind of started to bring the idea of, well, maybe Steadicam is interesting here to follow Tellis. He's going through one after another, after another, after another. And that's where that came from, you know? So I think you start from the scene, you start from what someone is feeling. Do we need to be intensely close to the character? Does handheld make sense here? Do we want to be standoffish? Do we want the viewer to be able to look at the whole picture? Does dolly make sense here? You know, and then you make aesthetic decisions based on that, you know?
I love that you mentioned that you kind of grew up with the 40s and the 50s and the 60s into the 70s.
Yeah.
What was the first time, the first movie, the first DP, the first shot? It doesn't matter. When did you realize this is something that that I'm interested in. Oh, wow. I want to do that.
Oh, wow. Yikes. I mean, I don't think I ever knew what a cinematographer was. So I don't think I ever really saw anything and was like, oh, who's the cinematographer on that? You know, especially in my, you know, we had a little video store that was, you know, like 10 minutes away from where I grew up. They had some cool stuff in there. And I don't think that I ever, I think there were a few times where I was like pricked by seeing stuff. I never thought about who the cinematographers were, but I remember seeing Claire Denis's Beau Travail and just being like, whoa, what is going on here? There's something really unique in this film. I can't put my hand, I can't put my hand on it. I don't really know, but this is like, this is really beautiful and really interesting and makes me feel something. And that also is true of Julie Chaymor's Titus, you know, which I also was just randomly on the VHS shelf and I picked out, and I wasn't even like being thoughtful about it. I was just, oh, this is an interesting cover, da 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 da, you know, whatever. So I think those two movies were things that I saw early on. And then in college, I took some film theory classes, and I remember seeing Passion of Joan of Arc, you know, Dreyer's film, and just being like, okay, now I'm noticing the framing. Now I'm thinking about who is the person that shot this? Who is the person that put these images together, both from a editorial and also from a cinematography and directing standpoint as well. But you know, my mind wasn't focused on it as a career, as an industry. I was still more interested in anthropology, and I was more interested in documentary filmmaking. But those are the first sort of images I would say that I was really taken with, and which I still think about all the time. I mean, you know, I rewatch those movies all the time because they're definitely up there on my, you know, favorite 50 or whatever. So
I love that you mentioned editing, because I was just talking to Eric Messerschmidt on the last episode, and
yeah,
it's really this collaboration between the cinematographer and the editor. Like, he's really thinking about it. How much are you thinking about the editing, and really how underappreciated is the editing? To it's still like, we have to have this discussion every year. Is it going to be broadcast at the Oscars? It's goddamn editing. Right. It's like just as important as cinematography. How do you look at this?
Well, I think someone once said to me, a film is made three times. It's made in the writing, it's made in the shooting, and it's made in the editing. And I think that's so true. You know, what I shoot, like I generally speaking am close with the editors that I work with. I generally speaking, because I came up as a documentarian, I was kind of a one man band. You know, I was shooting what I was shooting in the day. I was editing it at night. I was trying to do audio. That's definitely my worst one man band thing that I'm the worst at, but you know, I trying to do, you know, all of these things, producing all these things at once. And so it sort of, taught me the value of all of these specialties in the way that, you know, I would shoot something during the day and then I would be trying to put it together, you know, on my laptop in Final Cut Pro or whatever, and realizing it didn't work, or it didn't cut together nicely, or, oh, hey, actually, if I go on the movement of that shot to the movement of that shot, that'll kind of work a little better. And so, you know, it was through that figuring out and that learning that I became, you know, as interested in how the image that I create is going to be edited as how it is shot. And I often like to work very closely with the editors that I'm on films with, to talk to them about, oh, do you think this is a good idea? Do you think this is, you know, do you think this is worth pursuing? Could you do a transition here that would work, you know? I think, you know, editing is as important as the screenwriter, as important as the DP. You know, there's really no hierarchy there for me.
Going back into DP a little bit, are we at a level of low light right now in digital camera technology that you're happy with? Or do you find yourself always trying to push that limit even further?
I mean, certainly I'm excited by what we can do now, but yeah, of course you want to push it. You know, I mean, I think the big thing for me is that I like the idea of being able to, if you're doing a dark scene, I like the idea of being able to do a dark scene with very little light. And I think that allows the actors to feel more about what a dark scene should feel like. You know, if you're shooting it on 35 mil, there's no way you're going to be able to actually expose the film enough to bring those lights down to such a level that the actors are actually searching for something or are actually you knowing where the light source is and, you know, putting their body in it to express something. You know, on the card counter, we had this great scene between Oscar Isaac and Ty Sheridan where Oscar is sort of going to torture Ty. And you know, it was a very, I wanted it to feel like a very dark scene. And that was the first time using the Alexa LF, shooting 1280 ASA on these, you know, RADNA primes, which are very fast lenses, that, you know, we had a light mat and some Asteras, and that was kind of it. You know, and it felt dark in that room and it felt moody in that room. And it didn't necessarily feel like all the film stuff was there. And I think as a result, we got some really incredible performances. I mean, yeah, regardless of what I did, it would have been incredible performances. But I hope that what we were able to bring in this very low level lighting was to emphasize what the characters were going through. And to bring something else that they could use in their performance that felt naturalistic, but also felt heightened, you know, in that moment.
Okay, well, on the other side of the coin, are you satisfied with how far like lights like the S360 have gone in allowing for innovation in top light? Or do you try to stay away from bigger units like this and just as kind of as much as you can?
You know, I mean, really ultimately, it's about what I'm doing. You know, it's about the story and it's about actor freedom and it's about budget too. You know, you don't always have the ability to get a big expensive light like a 360. And so you have to use other means or figure out other things in order to sort of make it all work. I mean, listen, there's no better looking thing than a big light far away through many layers of diffusion, in my opinion. You know, I think that's how people have been doing it for a long time, and there's a reason. But you know, when you're working in a 5 by 10 foot room and it's a motel room, you know, does a big light really help you? You know,
Nothing like bringing an
how,
18K in there.
yeah, there's, I mean, you know, if you're, yeah, it looks fake. You know, there's no space, there's barely any space for the camera. So, do you light from outside, or, you know, is it a long enough scene, or is it a short enough scene where, you know, you could get away with what's going on outside and then balance your lights inside to that? You know, I mean, that's the great advantage of LEDs in general is that, you know, I can be on set, I can be in a little 10 by 5 motel room, I can get the camera in there, you know, on a little PV dolly. And, I can have an LED unit that can match what's going on outside and can create a little fill, and it's three lines, and we're out of the scene, you know. So I think it really just depends on what the environment is. You know, the flip side of that is you're in this room, this 5 by 10 room, and you have a 4-page talking scene. And you know, then you put diffusion in front of the windows and you bring that big 360 in, and that's your light, and that keeps, you know, a great consistency throughout this 4-page scene. So really it just depends on the environment that you're in, what you're trying to bring to that. But yeah, the 360 is a great light. There are lots of great LEDs now on the market as well that allow for that flexibility. And that's, I guess, what I'm more excited about is just the added flexibility of being able to make split second decisions because you have technology that kind of is balanced enough and pretty enough and can keep up with you as a result.
Well, yeah, it must be nice just to be able to grab an Astera kit at this point and get whatever you need done on the fly than having to worry about what am I going to do with these 318Ks and yeah, how am I going to light this?
Yeah, completely.
Okay, what you did with fabric lighting in the card counter, it's fucking amazing. Let's just be quite honest. From like the way that you would hit a muslin added so much character to those shots. Like it's incredible. How much are you thinking about the rags before you start shooting a film?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always thinking about diffusion and what's right for characters and stories, you know, how we can bend or soften the light in order to kind of emphasize what characters are going through. I mean, I made this film After Love with director Aleem Khan, and the main character in that movie, you know, she lives in England and kind of has this very homey life there, and then goes to France where she discovers that her husband had a whole second family. And we wanted some to a way, you know, or I wanted something with the lighting to reflect, you know, the kind of change in demeanor and the change in her environment. And so Liam and I talked a lot about how the diffusion and the ways that she's shot within these two places could kind of separate and give these visual markers. So when we're in England, you know, I used very soft light, you know, through multiple layers of diffusion. Whereas when we were in France, you know, I asked the AD to schedule our day so that our day exteriors were when the sun is at its toppiest, when it's at its highest and its harshest. And a lot of people would, you know, be like, well, why would you do that? You know, we should shoot an interior scene during then because we don't want to deal with this harsh, toppy sun that creates these terrible shadows. But for me, it was this great opportunity to kind of transform her and make the difference between how that character is emotionally feeling felt. So I'm always trying to do that. And I test a lot before in pre-production. And I kind of get down to the granular element of it. And you know, so the director and the crew all know, you know, in scenes ABC, we want to do this type of diffusion. And then in scenes, you know, XYZ, we want to do this type of diffusion. And everyone, you know, has seen an image, has seen a test, has an idea of where we're going, so that we're sort of all on the same page. And obviously things all change all the time and you discover things. I mean, I remember I had a very specific idea in the card counter about what I wanted to do diffusion wise and what kind of, I was thinking a lot about grids at that time. And First Reformed is a lot of bleached muslin, but I was kind of, you know, interested in grids. And then I got there on day one and, you know, put a 360 or actually put an S60 through, you know, a grid and realized, oh man, this is not the look of this movie at all. And then I started book lighting and I thought, okay, now I just need to book light everything on this movie. And as a result, that's where that feeling came from. You know, we were too wide and the characters were moving too much and the direct light just felt fake. And so it kind of all comes as you're on set once you have an initial plan.
I love that you mentioned the contrast in After Love, because I was going to ask you about that, because I really, I loved the contrast between the two places. And I was wondering how hard it was to be dealing with the harsher light in the Paris sequences, as opposed to the London sequences that look very, I guess, scheduled and planned.
Sorry, actually, I see that there's a 10 minutes left on the, is that?
Yeah, I'm not sure why that's coming up.
I don't know if you want to.
Can we just close and start it back up and maybe it'll reset itself?
Okay, definitely. Let's do that. Yeah. Yeah, sounds good. The same one?
Same one.
Same link?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Hopefully that fixed all itself.
Right. Sorry, I can't hear you. Can you hear me?
Yep, I can hear you.
Muted.
I can hear you. I can hear you. You're good. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Hello, hello.
Apologies, Robert. I can't hear you. It looks like your audio is off.
How about
though.
This?
Okay. There we go. We're back.
Hopefully everything's fixed now.
Okay, great. Will you ask that question again?
Well, just how hard was it dealing with the harsher light in After Love? Because it kind of, to me, felt like, yeah, you had a limited window, especially just watching the film. It was like, I just wonder how hard it was of a work day to try to cram things in. What was it, or was it not?
Yeah, I mean, you know, listen, everything on a film set is rushed, you know, I mean, even like, I remember seeing, there's this, God, actually, forget about that. I can take that out. Anyway, everything on a film set is rushed. And you're always fighting for time, you know, fighting to give the most time to the actors, trying to keep things consistent. It's always a challenge, but, you know, you try your best to look at all the weather predictions. You try your best to be flexible with the AD. You know, hey, I can say shave 10 minutes off this scene if, you know, you can give me 10 minutes here. You know, you just, there's a lot of things that you can't predict and you just have to kind of roll with it. But the intention, I think, as long as you try to have an intention with something and then kind of work to, try to make sure that that makes sense, then that's the best you can do. And then, you know, beyond that, some of it is like trying to fix things that didn't quite work with your colorist. You know, I have a great relationship with Tim Masick, who I get to work with as a colorist. And we're constantly trying to match things and fix it and sort of make it all work. So there you go. I think you got your dog barking.
Yeah, she's losing it. Just ignore her.
Okay, sounds good.
How did you and Paul Schrader's relationship come to be? And did you kind of think it was going to end up to where it is now when you first met him?
Oh yeah. God, definitely not. I mean, you know, like a lot of things in life, luck, you know, I met for this movie Dog Eat Dog that we made together. And someone else said no. And he hired me because he liked my ideas and had a good reference from a friend of a friend. We went on to make that movie, and it was a very interesting movie and really interesting experience. And at the end of that movie, Paul said, oh, I've got this other script with Ethan Hawke, and he plays a pastor, and told me a little bit about it. And I was like, well, that sounds incredible. And someone else said no, and he hired me again. And so it sort of has our story of collaboration has kind of gone from there. It's been incredible. I mean, he is just, and he's one of the great American directors, you know, and to get to work with him has been one of the great collaborations that I've been able to be a part of. And it was also really awesome to get to do Dog Eat Dog together before First Reformed, because I was a lot more confident in offering my opinion on things on First Reformed and giving my ideas or my perspective, because he liked me enough to bring me back. So there's always that that confidence that kind of grows. And First Reformed, as a result, became an incredible collaboration, not only between, you know, me and Paul, but with Chris Young, the production designer, Olga Mill, the costume designer, and, you know, really any, I had an incredible New York crew on that project as well. So it was just, and Frank Murray, the producer. So it was just like, it was just incredible luck to get to meet on Dog Eat Dog. I mean, that, you know, and then for him to feel that I was valuing his aesthetic enough, or interested in his aesthetic enough, or pushing his aesthetic enough to a place that he was excited about. And that's what we've tried to do with First Reformed, Card Counter, and Master Gardener, is all sort of value them as part of a single body of work. you know, some may refer to it as a trilogy. I think trilogy is probably apt, but I don't know if Paul sees it that way because he has a lot of those ideas through a lot of his films. I mean, think about, you know, Light Sleeper. That certainly fits within the mold of Card Counter and First Reformed and Master Gardener. But it's been an amazing challenge. And Light Sleeper, you know, shot by the incredible Ed Lockman. I mean, everything that is being done in First Reformed is me stealing from him, basically. So, but it's been really cool to think about these three films together and think about how the aesthetic strands can be linked in both what camera I'm using, in the approach of the cinematography, and the approach of the lighting, in the approach of how we're capturing the actors, and, you know, kind of laying that out, and a cool challenge to how do we continually try to reinvent this idea yet keep it together in the same mold.
Well, and as much as First Reformed, and The Card Counter are pretty like linked, they are still very different. So coming into The Master Gardener here, what can we expect? Did you kind of take a different approach? Were you still thinking about how this plays into something like The Card Counter, or was it kind of looked at as its own separate thing right from the get-go?
Yeah, I mean, always you know, it's a different story, but yet it's one of Paul's like man in room films. And so as a result, you want it to pay homage and also be in line with the other man in room films, especially since we've made these three films back to back. You know, we haven't gone and done a Western or something else in between. He's continued to focus on making this type of film because this is what he has to say right now. So I was very cognizant of, you know, where all of these set. You know, First Reformed was the Alexa SXT with Master Primes, you know, focusing on this Bresson-inspired, Dreyer-inspired kind of deep stop cinematography without moving the camera. Then Card Counter, looser, but still I'm using the Alexa LF, wanting the, with the DNA primes, wanting to respect the sort of crispness that we established in First Reformed, but at the same time also use the heightened depth of field with the LF to isolate William Tell, Oscar Isaac's character even more, going from 137 in First Reformed to 166 in Card Counter, but then introducing ideas like Steadicam, you know, and moving the camera into to films like Card Counter. So, you know, where does that bring us to Master Gardener? You know, it brings us wanting to use Steadicam again. It brings us to choosing to shoot it anamorphic and going to 2:39:1 because, you know, so much of it's set in gardens, and Paul wanted to really think about the beauty, the aesthetic beauty of gardens and how that could reflect on the characters. But keeping a kind of classical film approach with Steadicam, but cameras on a dolly, camera moves when the characters move, except if it's, you know, some sort of exaggerated sequence like you have in each of Paul's films. I think there's always a desire to keep them all together, to think of them as a unit, but also to continue to push. And hopefully people will feel that within Master Gardener.
Dealing with like gardens, was there ever the thought of maybe like mixing formats and having some 35 elements to it, or was that never even kind of discussed?
No, that was never really discussed. I mean, Paul likes digital cinematography. He likes making films digitally because it's a speed thing. It's right there for him to see and comment on. And I think he is someone who always embraces new technology. I mean, that's always what's so exciting. You know, I constantly get emails from Paul, you know, titled like, this on the iPhone ? You know, and it's some app or it's some device or it's something, you know, he always like wants to free himself from, you know, the feelings that I think that he had early in his career with big crews and big productions and the lack of freedom that that gives. And then, you know, also like we're making films at a price point that don't have the luxury of time, you know, Card Counter, Master Gardener, First Reformed, they're all made in under 22, 23 days. In order for that to work, I think you kind of have to shoot digitally, you know, and you kind of have to aesthetically choose something that works within that environment. As much as we talk about all these great films and they go into the sort of stew of this is what the idea for this film is going to be, there's a reality of the technical side of it that also is important and goes into that stew and making the most out of that, you know. Not moving the camera on First Reformed is as much an aesthetic decision that reinforces the characters as it is, we're making a small film. We can't afford to see beyond where the camera is going to move, you know, so, or the, where the camera is sitting. And so let's put all the resources we can into making that frame feel the most impactful.
How much do you utilize like apps on your phone, for instance? Are you using like light meter kind of things on your phone? And how much have you used that as a tool going forward? Just your everyday pulling out your phone?
Yeah. Yeah, I use my phone a lot. I use my phone and I use iPads a lot. I mean, between my iPhone and my iPads, I feel there's a lot of tools. You know, I'll use a digital finder on my phone, and that will help. And I'll show Paul images and I'll show, oh, this is, you know, even there have been instances where with Aleem on After Love, you know, we were running out of time in the day. And I proposed, oh, well, you could shoot this, this, and this. And he was, and, you know, he sort of looked at me like, well, I don't understand that. And then you get the phone out and you say, okay, you could do this, then you do this, then you do this. And then you can flip between them. And, oh, now I see the cuts. Yes, let's go, let's go. You know, so it's, they're great tools for the immediacy of them. You know, obviously every, you know, it's not as accurate as, you know, pulling out an original finder and an optical finder and putting it up. And I'll use that all the time too, especially if I'm trying to get ahead, you know, leave the operator with the camera, the gaffer knows what they're doing. I've got to go set up another shot. Let me mark this out. I'll take the finder. I'll go, you know. I think I'm a huge believer in using all those tools. And then at the end of the day, you know, with my DIT, I am asking for stills at the end of the day. I want to see all the color, all the dailies, you know, and because I won't have time to watch dailies until the weekend, given the hours that are often required. So I want to go home at the end of the day and I want to look at all the stills that from the day. And I want to know, oh, okay, well, I know that when I come back to that scene, I want to do this X, Y, and Z, or I know that this brown is not the brown I was thinking of. Let's lift that a little bit. You know, it allows me to deliver something that I think is as close to what the director is feeling and seeing, as we talked about in prep, as we saw in production. And hopefully that they will live with in editorial. I mean, you know, a sort of funny sort of anecdote is in First Reformed, there's a scene where Toler goes to a ship graveyard and we get this insane sunset. And I had not really looked at the dailies. And I had not had been able, we were kind of offsite, we were all around. It was this like crazy push in Staten Island. And the DIT just thought, oh, these are cool colors, let me just amp them up, you know. And Paul started seeing that in editorial, because I hadn't caught it by the time he started editing it, because he's editing as he's shooting. And so when it came time to do the color grade, I tamped all those colors down. I made it like this very realistic thing. And Paul comes in to the grade, and he's like, you know, where are my colors? Where is the exuberance of that scene? What do you mean? And I was like, well, that was a mistake on set. Like, obviously this is what we want to do. And he was like, no. I want it to be hallucinogenic. And so, you know, there's an instance where, you know, maybe I didn't catch it soon enough. Maybe he fell in love with it in the edit suite. Regardless, I want the director to feel as comfortable with the image that they're seeing in the edit suite as possible, and as excited by that image as what will eventually be seen on screen and improve from there.
Well, what can we expect from you coming up?
Next projects?
Yeah.
You know, I'm reading a lot of scripts and I'm figuring out next steps, and just going from there. I float back and forth between commercials and film projects, and I've been concentrating on commercials at the current moment. But you know, I just had Goodnight Mommy, the Amazon remake, premiere a few months back, and Master Gardener was just picked up by Magnolia and will be out in theaters in May of next year. So those things.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. You're always welcome to come back on, please. Next project, come on in. We'll get nerdy again.
Great. That'd be awesome.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Robert. All right. Talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening. This concludes our broadcast day.